Today we're going to talk about why COVID-19 is not the third leading cause of death, as has been told by Dr. Thomas Friedman, former director of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. I will also talk about some statistics that indicate some of our previous reports from the media are not correct. Why putting COVID-19 patients in nursing homes is a bad idea. And medical treatments which show promise have been censored and even barred from use based on falsified and seriously flawed studies. The source of this information is the Joseph Mercola newsletter. Well, Dr. Thomas Friedman said that COVID-19 is the third leading cause of death in the United States, killing more Americans than accidents, injuries, lung disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and many, many other causes. This claim is said to be based on data from Johns Hopkins University, which, at the time Friedman made that statement in August, reported about 170,000 of the 5.4 million Americans who tested positive had died. At the same time of that writing, Johns Hopkins reported the U.S. had recorded 7,916,099 positive tests and 216,872 COVID-19 related deaths. There are many reasons not to panic over Friedman's claims. I want to highlight a leading cause of death that continues to be swept under the proverbial rug, namely medical errors, because medical errors also play a role in the death toll attributed to COVID-19. In a 2016 Johns Hopkins study, it found more than 250,000 Americans die each year from preventable medical errors, effectively making modern medicine the third leading cause of death in the United States. In 2017, medical mistakes were found to affect 1 in 5 people. Common examples of medical mistakes included receiving the wrong medications, having the wrong procedure done, waking up during surgery, or acquiring a hospital-related infection. Other research has estimated the number of Americans dying from medical mistakes may actually be as high as 440,000. The reason for the discrepancy in the numbers is because medical errors are rarely noted on death certificates, and death certificates are what the CDC relies on to compile its death statistics. As a result, the severity of the problem goes unnoticed. Either way, whether it's 250,000 or 440,000, medical errors still claim more lives than COVID-19, and it does so on an annual basis. We also need to remember that a large portion of those who died from COVID-19 were, in fact, victims of medical errors. According to retired Army Sergeant Aaron Olazinski, a nurse who worked at Elmhurst during the height of the pandemic, hospital administrators and doctors made a long list of errors. The most egregious was to place all COVID-19 patients including those merely suspected of having COVID-19, on mechanical ventilation rather than less invasive oxygen administration. During her time there, most patients who entered the hospital wound up being treated for COVID-19, whether they tested positive or not, and only one patient survived. The hospital also failed to segregate COVID-positive and COVID-negative patients, thereby ensuring maximum spread of the disease among non-infected patients coming in with other health problems. By ventilating COVID-19 negative patients, the hospital artificially inflated the caseload and death rate. In my quest to find truth just below the surface, I find that following the money often takes me where I'm wanting to go. According to the nurse, the hospital received $29,000 extra for a COVID-19 patient that received ventilation, over and above other treatments. In August 2020, Director Robert Redfield admitted that hospital incentives likely elevated hospitalization rates and death toll statistics around the country. Another major error that drove up the death toll was state leadership's decision to place infected patients into nursing homes, which was against federal guidelines. According to an analysis by the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, an average of 42% of all COVID-19 deaths in the United States had occurred in nursing homes, assisted living, and other long-term care facilities. This is extraordinary, considering that this group accounts for just 0.62% of the population. By and large, nursing homes are ill-equipped to care for COVID-19 infected patients. While they're set up to care for elderly patients, whether they are generally healthy or have chronic health problems, these facilities are rarely equipped to quarantine and care for people with highly infectious disease. It is logical to assume that commingling infected patients with non-infected ones in a nursing home would result in exaggerated death rates, as the elderly are far more prone to die from any infection, including the common cold. We also learned early on that the elderly were disproportionately vulnerable to severe SARS-CoV-2 infection. Yet, ordering infected patients into nursing homes with the most vulnerable population of all is exactly what several Democratic governors decided to do, including New York Andrew Cuomo, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and California Governor Gavin Newsom. ProPublica published an investigation in June of 2020 comparing a New York nursing home that followed Cuomo's misguided order with one that refused, opting to follow the federal guidelines instead. And the difference was stark. By June 18th, the Diamond Hill nursing home, which followed Cuomo's directive, had lost 18 residents to COVID-19, thanks to the lack of isolation and inadequate infection control. Half the staff, about 50 people, and 58 patients were infected and fell ill. In comparison, Van Rensselaer Manor, a 320-bed nursing home located in the same county as Diamond Hill, which refused to follow the state's directive and did not admit any patient suspected of having COVID-19, did not have a single COVID death. A similar trend was observed in other areas. If it wasn't for systematic medical mistreatment at certain hospitals and incomprehensible decision-making by a handful of state governors, the COVID-19 death toll may well have been negligible. We should also remember that the vast majority of people died with SARS-CoV-2 infection, not from it, and medical treatments showing significant promise have been savagely censored and even barred from use based on falsified and seriously flawed studies. According to data released by the CDC in August, only 6% of the total COVID-19 related deaths in the United States had COVID-19 listed as the sole cause of death on the death certificate. 6% of the total death reported by the CDC is 12,068. In other words, the SARS-CoV-2 infection was directly responsible for just over 12,000 deaths of otherwise healthy individuals. The remaining 94% had an average of 2.6 health conditions that contributed to their deaths. When you add up all of these factors together, the wanton mismanagement of the infection in hot spots such as New York, the decision to send infected patients into nursing homes, the fact that few healthy people died from the infection, and that potential medical treatments have been and still are actively suppressed, it starts to look like a manufactured crisis. While Frieden is now stoking fears by claiming COVID-19 is the third leading cause of death, and Scientific American is calling the claim that its fatality is on par with the flu fake news, I would call your attention to research looking at the fatality ratio for the average person, excluding those residing in nursing homes and other long-term facilities. The overall non-institutionalized infection fatality rate of COVID-19 was only 0.26%. Persons younger than 40 had an infection fatality ratio of 0.01%. Those aged 60 or older had an infection fatality of 1.71%. This was from the Annals of Internal Medicine, September 2, 2020. Because many who test positive for SARS-CoV-2 remain asymptomatic, it's very difficult to estimate the true infection rate, and when calculating mortality rates based on confirmed cases, that meaning positive test, you end up overestimating the infection fatality ratio. The estimated infection fatality rate for seasonal influenza is 0.8%. Other sources put it slightly higher, but in any case, according to this paper, the only people from whom SARS-CoV-2 infection is more dangerous than influenza are those over the age of 60. All others have a lower risk of dying from COVID-19 than they have of dying from the flu. Put it another way, if you're under the age of 60, your chance of dying from the flu is greater than your chance of dying from COVID-19. White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx also confirm that this far lower than typically reported mortality rate, when she in mid-August stated that it becomes more and more difficult to get people to comply with mask rules when people start to realize that 99% of us are going to be fine. In addition to COVID-19 having a lethality on par with the flu, again for the average person under the age of 60, data shows the overall cause mortality has remained steady during 2020 and doesn't veer from the norm. In other words, COVID-19 has not killed off more of the population than would have died anyway in any given year. Several studies also suggest immunity against SARS-CoV-2 infection is far more widespread than anyone imagined. The threshold for herd immunity appears to be far lower than previously estimated. As reported by British Sky News in October the 7th of 2020, respected scientists are now calling for a herd immunity approach to the pandemic, meaning governments should allow people who are not at significant risk of COVID-19 illness to go back to normal life. As of October the 18th, 2020, the Great Barrington Declaration had been signed by over 10,000 medical and public health scientists and over 29,000 medical practitioners. And now I am going to explain to you what this Great Barrington Declaration said. Great Barrington is in Massachusetts, and the Great Barrington Declaration, as infectious disease epidemiologists and public health scientists, we have grave concerns about the damaging physical and mental health impacts of the prevailing COVID-19 policies and recommend an approach we call focused protection. Coming from both the left and the right and around the world, we have devoted our careers to protecting people. Current lockdown policies are producing devastating effects on short and long-term public health. The results, to name a few, include lower childhood vaccination rates, worsening cardiovascular disease outcomes, fewer cancer screenings, and deteriorating mental health, leading to greater excess mortality in years to come, with the working class and younger members of society carrying the heaviest burden. Keeping students out of school is a grave injustice. Keeping these measures in place until a vaccine is available will cause irreparable damage, with the underprivileged disproportionately harmed. Fortunately, our understanding of the virus is growing. We know that vulnerability to death from COVID-19 is more than 1,000-fold higher in the old and infirm than in the young. Indeed, for children, COVID-19 is less dangerous than many other harms, including influenza. As immunity builds in the population, the risk of infection to all, including the vulnerable, falls. We know that all populations will eventually reach herd immunity. That is the point at which the rate of new infections is stable, and that this can be assisted by, but is not dependent upon, a vaccine. Our goal should therefore be to minimize mortality and social harm until we reach herd immunity. The most compassionate approach that balances the risk and benefits of reaching herd immunity is to allow those who are at minimal risk of death to live lives normally, to build up immunity to the virus through natural infection, while better protecting those who are at highest risk. And we call this focused protection. Adopting measures to protect the vulnerable should be the central aim of public health response to COVID-19. By way of example, nursing homes should use staff with acquired immunity and perform frequent PCR testing of other staff and all visitors. Staff rotation should be minimized. Retired people living at home should have groceries and other essentials delivered to their home. When possible, they should meet family members outside rather than inside. A comprehensive and detailed list of measures, including approaches to multi-generational households, can be implemented and is well within the scope and capacity of public health professionals. Those who are not vulnerable should immediately be allowed to resume life as normal. Simple hygiene measures, such as hand washing and staying home when sick, should be practiced by everyone to reduce the herd immunity threshold. Schools and universities should be open for in-person teaching. Extracurricular activities, such as sports, should be resumed. Young, low-risk adults should work normally rather than from home. Restaurants and other businesses should open. Arts, music, sport, and other cultural activities should resume. People who are more at risk may participate if they wish, while society as a whole enjoys the protection conferred upon the vulnerable by those who have built up herd immunity. Now, this was signed on October the 4th of 2020 in Great Barrington, as I stated. Among the signers was Dr. Martin Kulldorff, professor of medicine at Harvard University, a biostatistician and epidemiologist with expertise in detecting and monitoring infectious disease outbreaks and vaccine safety evaluation. Dr. Sunetra Gupta, professor at Oxford University, an epidemiologist with expertise in immunology, vaccine development, and mathematical modeling of infectious diseases. And Dr. J. Bhattacharya, professor at Stanford University Medical School, a physician, epidemiologist, health economist, and public health policy expert focusing on infectious diseases and vulnerable populations. At this stage in the game, there's plenty of cause for optimism. In addition to data showing COVID-19 is nowhere near as lethal as was initially suspected, we now have a number of safe and effective treatments. Some of these treatments include nebulized hydrogen peroxide, the Math Plus protocol developed by the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Working Group, the vitamin D use at higher levels to increase immunity. Studies show that those with adequate vitamin D levels are far less likely to become positive for SARS-CoV-2, less likely to develop symptoms if infected, and less likely to suffer complications, serious illness, and death. Other treatments include oral zinc and oral hydroxychloroquine. Well, that ends this podcast, bringing you truth just below the surface. I hope you found some of these truthful ideas, which you are not likely to hear about on national media, worth your time. to evaluate. If you have been following my programs, you know that my mission or purpose in life is to spread a message that there is a cure for all addictive behaviors. Now, this is a spiritual cure, and the treatment program is profiled in my book, Freedom from Addiction 3. It is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. If you meet three simple criteria, everyone gets well. I have two free resources where you can start your journey. The first is a link to my free podcast, and that link is www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com. Spell Libsyn, L-I-B as in boy, S-Y-N. All lowercase and no spaces between the words. And for more detail about my treatment for addictive behaviors, go to www.revwynhendersonmd.com. My Twitter account is at Hugo the Artist. Here you will find hundreds and hundreds of inspirational and educational daily tweets, mostly in terms of quotes from celebrities and non-celebrities alike.